everybody. It's time for It's All About Food. And it's November 4th, 2014. I'm Karen Hartglass, and I'm really glad to be here today and have you with me here. We're going to have a great show today. First, I want to let you know I'm back on the East Coast. I was in California for a few weeks, and now I'm back home. I took a red eye last night, and I'm a little tired. But I'm doing whatever I can to make up for that. And it's Election Day, and I hope you've gotten out to vote here in the United States. And if you haven't yet, get out there and vote. We have that big GMO labeling thing going on in Oregon and Colorado. And if you're in those states, I hope you're getting your voice heard with your vote. It is so important. I know those big companies are throwing a lot of money to keep things at the status quo, which is not acceptable. And we can make a difference with our votes. So we're very lucky today because we're going to be learning the best in nutrition from a superhero in nutrition, and I'm going to bring on my first guest, Brenda Davis, and she's a registered dietitian, a leader in her field, an internationally acclaimed speaker. She's co-authored 9 vegetarian and vegan nutrition classics, including Becoming Vegan, the Express Edition, and Becoming Vegan Comprehension Edition. We're going to be talking a little bit about those today. And in 2007, she was inducted into the Vegetarian Hall of Fame. I told you, a superhero. Brenda, welcome to It's All About Food.
Oh, thank you very much, Karen. It's great to be here, and thank you for all the lovely compliments.
Yeah, you should be running around with a cape.
I don't know about that.
Because you're making a difference in so many people's lives, and you're really saving lives, just like a superhero would.
Oh, thank you. We're doing our best, and I think we all contribute in our own little way, and it works.
Yeah, but you have been so true to this mission for so long with a great deal of passion and walking the walk, and I thank you for that.
Well, thank you.
So let's get down to what's new in nutrition and in your Express Edition and Comprehensive Edition. Now, they're both pretty comprehensive. The Express Edition is close to 300 pages. And the Comprehensive, I imagine that's for people who want, like medical professionals, nutritionists, and people who just really want to get down to all the dirty details.
Yeah, really want all of the references and a little more information. And so it's about 611 pages. And to be honest, it was cut by about 25% in the editing. So,
oh, okay. Yeah. What did we miss out, dude? Can we get the outtake somewhere?
Oh, boy.
Or maybe that'll come out in the next
book. I think our editors did a good job to get it crammed into a smaller space.
Yeah. Well, it's great. So what I wanted to focus on today is fats and essential oils. And if we have enough time, maybe we can touch some other things. But
okay.
Let's just jump into fats, healthy fats, and then kind of morph into like omega-3s and omega-6s and
right.
Those tasty items.
Yep. Yeah.
So are fats good or are they bad?
Fats are, you know, both. Some fats are not only good, they're essential for life. If we didn't have them, we couldn't survive. Some are bad because they contribute to, harmful effects in the body and all sorts of disease processes and so forth. So some fats are great and some fats are not so great.
And I think a lot of my listeners know that that whole plant foods give us the best options for all kinds of micro and macronutrients, including fats. But it comes down to is when we're splitting hairs and we want to know things like is it okay to use oil? When is oil okay? What kind of oil? Maybe you could talk a little bit about that. That always raises a lot of excitement in people.
Well, one of the things that I always like to tell people is to look around the world at the people that are living the longest, healthiest lives. And we've got something called the Blue Zones. For people that aren't familiar with the Blue Zones, these are the places in the world where people live, you know, to be 90 or 100 and at those advanced ages are still very productive and still in their gardens and still relatively healthy. And so I sometimes think of, you know, comparing whatever it is we're thinking about to the Blue Zone people kind of as our acid test. And if you think that way and you look at the amount of fat and oil and so forth that they're using, one thing will really strike you, and that is the tremendous diversity in fat intakes among these populations. Mm. So you can go somewhere like Okinawa, Japan, and they're taking in 10 or 11, in their traditional diet, of course, 10 or 11% of calories from fat, whereas the people from Icaria, Greece, or Sardinia, Italy, are getting, you know, 35% of calories from fat. And the people in the Nicoya Peninsula and at Loma Linda, California, may be around 30% of calories from fat. So there's really a lot of discrepancy, even among the Blue Zones. And the deal is that the macronutrient, the percentage of calories from macronutrients, especially carbohydrates and fats, matters far less than where those macronutrients are coming from. And so when people are getting these fats from, as you mentioned, whole plant foods, it's just like we think about sugar and pure starchy carbohydrates like white flour. Those are the refined versions, and when you eat your carbs in that form, they very consistently contribute to disease. It's the same with fat. When you eat very highly refined processed fats, they contribute to disease processes. When you get fats in a more whole food form, they don't. And so you look at where do people in you know, in the Mediterranean countries that are part of the Blue Zones, where do they get their fat from? And they do, you know, a lot of them do use some oil. But they do get a lot of their fat from things like olives and avocados as well. And so I think it depends a little bit on, you know, what your state of health is and your dietary goals. So, for example, we see these very, very low-fat vegan diets that are promoted, especially for people with coronary heart disease, and these have no added oils. They don't even use nuts and seeds and avocados, which I would differ a little bit on. But for people that are overweight and really need to reverse this atherosclerosis that's developed, a very low-fat diet can be very helpful. For a young child who we're trying to get to grow and develop and, you know, get their brain to the maximum capacity and all of those things, we need to think a little bit differently, and we want to make sure that they get the level of essential fatty acids and healthy fats that they need to grow and develop properly. And so it's, you know, it just all depends on, you know, what your situation is, your age, your health, et cetera. But as for the question of oils and can we include oils, I think what people again need to realize is most people in healthy populations use some oils. They're, you know, some not so much, as in Okinawa, they're using just very small amounts, and some significantly more, such as Sardinia, for example. But even that having been said, we need to recognize what these oils are. And these oils are really pure fat extracted from whole foods, of course. And, of course, in that process of extracting the fat, sometimes we expose those foods to toxic chemicals and just to you know, for the extraction. And then often they're deodorized and bleached and, you know, all of these things. And so there's various levels and a healthfulness of fat, of oils as well. So if you get a very, very high quality food and you fresh pressed it and it's not exposed to heat, and those oils will be more protective and more healthful than an oil that's been very, very highly refined.
They're going to taste better too. You're going to taste that fruitiness.
Exactly,
in them.
Exactly. And then the other thing, Karen, is that there are some people that really can't afford to eat much oil, if any. And the reason is that they need to maximize nutrient density. And so when you're talking about nutrient density, you're talking about getting the most nutrients you can per calorie, right? Mm-hmm. Well, there's no food on the planet that has fewer nutrients per calorie than oil. Oil is extremely, lacking in vitamins and minerals and so on. It's just basically pure fat with a little bit of vitamin E if it's, fresh pressed or vitamin E has been added. So it's not a very nutrient-dense food. And when a person's eating 1,400 or 1,600 calories a day and wanting to meet their nutritional requirements for everything, they don't have a lot of room for oil. Mm-hmm. They need to be focusing on getting their fat from whole foods, so nuts and seeds and avocados in moderate, amounts.
Well, what I love about what you said about these different areas that eat different amounts of fat, it just shows how smart our bodies can be when we feed them whole, minimally processed foods.
Absolutely.
They just, make whatever they need out of whatever we give them, and everything's fine.
Exactly. to an extent, there's still things like B12 and vitamin D and things like that we have to worry about. But in terms of macronutrients, absolutely.
Yeah, I love that. Now, a couple of fatty kind of foods have been in and out of the press over the last few years. I want to talk about butter from cow's milk.
Yeah,
and that's
kind
of gotten sexy again this year.
Oh, absolutely, especially after we, had the release of Chowdhury's study on saturated fats. And,
so,
people all of a sudden thinking, well, this is,
butter's back. Yay, I'm going to put it in my coffee every morning.
Yeah.
I mean, what is that about?
And it's just unfortunate because people are just really not understanding the reality of of saturated fats and what the deal is. And a lot of people don't understand this, but saturated fats have not been vindicated. saturated fats have what basically the research is showing is that you can replace saturated fats with carbs and either give yourself a boost or shoot yourself in the foot. If you replace saturated fat with refined carbohydrates like sugar and white flour products, you may be doing worse than by eating saturated fat. And that's what the studies are showing. They're not vindicating saturated. Saturated fat still contributes to, increases blood cholesterol levels and causes all sorts of problems. But what we're just starting to learn is that refined carbohydrates can be just as bad.
So once again, it comes down to how studies are set up. And sometimes when certain groups are looking for specific results, they design their studies in such a way to get them.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's for sure. Well, I can tell you, and I feel okay about telling you this, the Chowdhury study, one of the authors on that study, Dr. Francesca Crow, I contacted her to ask her about this study because I found it so surprising. She's involved with Epic Oxford, and Epic Oxford is, one of the biggest studies ever done on a population that has a lot of vegetarians in the population and vegans. And so this is a really, really important study. And I found it a little odd that she was involved in this this saturated fat study. And so I asked her, I said, could you explain to me what this study's really showing and if based on this study you would change your recommendations with regards to saturated fat intakes. And what she told me was that when the study was first conceived, the results of their initial meta-analysis showed very strongly that saturated fats were positively related to cardiovascular disease risk.
Mm-mm.
And then she said what happened was their paper was turned down.
Wow.
So then, after the journal rejected it, the analysis was rerun, changing the outcomes, and until it was something different. And then they, revised and submitted it to another journal, and it was accepted because it was so, such outstanding are startling results that might get a little bit of media attention.
Brenda,
and
how do we
said,
know? What, who
oh,
to
I know.
Trust?
And she said, because the paper was at such an advanced stage, she said, I found out a week before it was going to press, there wasn't anything I could do about it. And she said, I still think the best available evidence, and this is a direct quote, I just opened her email, I still think the best available evidence from randomized controlled trials, which are the gold standard, by the way, show that saturated fat intake affects blood cholesterol levels, which is an important risk factor for heart disease. Therefore, current guidelines, which are no more than 6 to 7% of calories from saturated fat, by the way, should still recommend that people minimize their intake of saturated fat. That's one of the key authors of the study. Okay? That's not what you heard from the media.
Nope, not at all.
Well, not at all.
At least we're hearing it from you. Thank you.
You know, so it's very, very frustrating for someone in my position to see that kind of stuff come out. And then if you look at, you know, people that are very, very well, you know, very, very, very well respected in the, you know, in the nutrition world, like Walter Willett, for example, he basically said this, you know, study has done so much damage, it should be retracted. And the press should give that retraction similar, press, and that he said that this, you know, study should basically serve as a warning about how bad meta-analyses can be.
Mm-hmm.
You know that it and so you know butter. So what is butter? Well, butter is a big block of saturated fat, of course. And it's fairly high in advanced glycation end products. It's not, you know, yes, it's people think of it as a real food as compared to margarine, which is more of a fake food with lots of chemicals added. But you actually have to look at, I mean, first of all, from my view, we don't really want to be eating either one of those things for health. You want to be eating nuts and seeds and avocados and olives and whole foods that provide healthy fats, that come with fiber and phytochemicals and antioxidants and things that are actually of value to human health. I don't think these studies in any way make butter all of a sudden of value to human health.
You know, when you mentioned Walter Willett wanted a retraction on this meta-analysis,
yeah.
I was thinking that just before you mentioned it, but even if someone did print a retraction, it would never be headline news.
No, it wouldn't be, and that's why he, you know, made that statement that it should be. And it's very unfortunate. And if you look even at, you know, some of the other co-authors' statements. It's really like there was another author that basically said the main problem with the paper was it was wrongly interpreted by the media. We're not saying that the current guidelines are wrong and people can eat as much saturated fat as they want. And that's coming from the authors.
Right. Well, listeners, I hope when you're hearing this and you have your butter-loving friends, you might share this interview when it goes up into the archives so that they can hear the truth. All right, let's move to omega-3s and omega-6s, and what's the fat and the skinny on all of that?
Yeah. So basically, you know, and again, people may not realize, often people think that you have to have fish for omega-3 fatty acids, right?
Yep.
And so, of course, vegetarians and vegans are not consuming fish, and so there's been a great concern that vegetarians and vegans could be deficient in these omega-3s. And so what people need to understand is really there are several omega-3s. So there's alpha-linolenic acid, which is the plant omega-3 that comes from flax seeds and walnuts and chia seeds and hemp seeds and so forth. And even greens, leafy greens, about half the fat is omega-3 in leafy greens. So there are those things that provide alpha-linolenic acid, and then the body has to convert alpha-linolenic acid to the more biologically active forms of omega-3s, which are eicosapentaenoic acid, or EPA, and docosahexaenoic acid, or DHA. And so EPA and DHA are the fats that people would get directly from fish, and they are more biologically active, which means they're important in, you know, reducing inflammation and, you know, all of those good things that we associate with omega-3 fatty acids. Alpha-linolenic acid can do a little bit, but the more active forms are these long-chain fats. So then the concern becomes, well, can vegetarians and vegans convert the alpha-linolenic acid, which is the plant omega-3, into these long-chain omega-3 fatty acids? And there's a couple of things that people, again, it's helpful to know. Number one is that fish don't make EPA and DHA. They don't actually produce it in their bodies. They get it from plants in the ocean. So microalgae is the source of production of EPA. And so the microalgae is basically the little tiny fish are eating the microalgae, and then bigger. So somewhere along the food chain, it's coming from plants in the ocean, the EPA and DHA.
Right.
So that's kind of good to know, because there are companies now that are culturing microalgae. And so they're growing, you know, this EPA and DHA that is plant-based that people can buy in supplement form, and sometimes it's added to things like soy milk or essential balanced oils and things like that. And I think we'll see it added to foods more and more. So there are some plant sources, but they're not accessible in most foods that we would consume. You know, most people would need to buy a supplement. But however, all of that being said, so what about this the whole conversion thing? Can we convert well enough? And the deal is that generally humans are thought to be able to convert, you know, reasonably well. There are lots of people in the world that are quite healthy that don't have a lot of access to fish, you know, more inland people.
Mm-hmm.
And they still seem to have well-functioning brains and do fine. What we do know is that vegetarians, and especially vegans, do have lower levels of EPA and DHA in their bloodstreams and in their tissues. And it's about maybe a third to a half that of the average omnivore that's eating fish. And so that, we don't know how bad that is. We're not really sure what optimal is.
Mm-hmm.
But we know that we can boost those levels. And there are two ways of doing that. One is to be eating enough ALA. And that used to be a big issue. People just didn't. And ALA, that means, you know, sprinkling some ground flaxseed on your cereal, or some chia seed, or making a chia seed pudding, or using hemp seeds. One thing that I do is I grind hemp seeds into my almond milk.
Mm.
And it makes the almond milk higher in protein, and it mm-hmm. adds a whole bunch of vitamins and minerals. So that's, you know, one way of adding hemp seeds and some omega-3 fatty acids. So, you know, eating a lot of greens. I mean, you'd have to eat like a horse or a cow to get enough omega-3s from greens, because you'd need about 30 cups of this stuff a day. So that's why it's important to have some seeds as well. And walnuts, too, can provide a reasonable amount. So we need to make sure we have enough. And then we also need to make sure that our bodies are in good enough health that conversion will happen. And there are several things that can interfere with the conversion. And so some of the more common things, men don't convert as well as women. That's nothing he can do anything about.
Yay.
And the reason is, you know why? It's just really simple. Women need to always be prepared to, and when I say women, I'm talking more about young women, so that would exclude us.
Mm-hmm. In the reproductive ages.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Reproductive age, because their bodies are, you know, always prepared to support the growth of a new baby, and the baby, you know, needs to grow a brain, which requires a lot of DHA.
Mm-hmm.
So their conversion is going to be good. DHA is the most highly unsaturated fat in the human diet. And so it is very unstable, which means it gets oxidized quickly. So you don't want a whole lot of it floating around in your blood if you don't need it, because it'll get oxidized. So generally, you know, if men that may not need quite as much, they just won't be converting as well, because they don't need as much.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then age, as you age, your conversion gets reduced. Smokers, you know, smoking depresses the enzymes that help you to convert, so that's not good. Chronic diseases like diabetes and hypertension can depress conversion. But the thing that we really have control over, when we look at our diet, the thing that decreases or depresses conversion the most is omega-6 fatty acids. And so we need omega-6 fatty acids. They're absolutely essential to life. They're essential in, you know, in just like omega-3 fatty acids are. The problem is that when we get a ton more omega-6 than omega-3, that they both compete for the same conversion enzymes, and so the omega-3s won't convert as well, and that's an issue. So generally, people might get 10 to 1 in terms of omega-6 to 3, and we want somewhere maybe 2 to 1, 3 to 1, mm-hmm. 4 to 1 at the most. And so it means that you still, you know, you still want to get your omega-6s from your pumpkin seeds and sunflower seeds and so forth, but you don't want to be using a lot of these oils that are omega-6 rich, like grapeseed oil and sunflower and safflower and corn oil and all of these kinds of oils that are mainly omega-6, because that can really shift your balance in a heck of a rush in the wrong direction.
Okay, I've been jotting a lot of notes down because you just rattled off so much information. But the first thing I want to say is, you know that you know what you're talking about when you can make music out of these acronyms and just roll off alpha-linolenic acid off your tongue and make music out of it. I'm not even going to attempt to say what DHA and EPA stand for, but you do it beautifully.
Oh, thank you.
But I'm glad the acronyms are there because it's too much for me. And what I'm getting here is that we don't really know how much we need, and we don't know vegans have less apparently, but we don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing yet.
Yeah.
And
we've got a good estimate of how much ALA we should be consuming if we don't take in any of these EPA DHA supplements. So what I've done is I basically have doubled the Institute of Medicine's recommendations. So vegans, a female needs 1.1 gram of ALA per day, or alpha-linolenic acid, and males need 1.6 if they're not vegan or vegetarian and they're eating fish. Mm. Now, if you don't eat fish, you need to double those numbers to make sure you have enough of the raw material for conversion. And so vegan women would need, you know, they would need 2.2 grams and men would need 3.2. And so that is a, now if you're taking the supplements, then you would only need the amount that is, you know, that people eating fish would need, because you're getting direct sources of EPA and DHA.
Right. Now the supplements, that's kind of a touchy subject. There's the vegan DHA, EPA, they're expensive.
Yeah,
I'm always challenged because they're in the refrigerator, and I always forget to take what's in the refrigerator on a regular basis. I don't know what, maybe I need more DHA to be able to manage that. I don't know, to remember that they're there. And then there's this Alzheimer's thing that's looming, and we all want to do what we can now to prevent something like that later. And then, they're made in a lab, and I think I remember reading that it's genetically modified.
Yeah, and there's definitely some controversy about that, and we don't have all the answers yet. But basically, I've looked at that information, and I just am not quite sure what to believe, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
They're culturing these plants in a lab. They say it's not genetic modification. Some people say it is. I really don't know. But what I do know is that that's, if you want to be vegan, that's pretty much your choice.
Right. It's either.
It's a really tough one. So I personally, myself, I rely mainly on ALA. So I eat a lot of, you know, chia seeds, hemp seeds, flax seeds. And once in a blue moon, I'll take a, you know, EPA DHA supplement. So maybe once a week or once every 2 weeks, if I remember. I'm not very good at doing that either.
Yeah.
but I did have my levels tested, and they were actually not bad. So they weren't at, you know, my DHA was a little bit low, at the lower end of normal, though. And
right.
My EPA was really, really in the middle of normal, so it was absolutely fine. So I figure I'm doing all right. We just have to do the best we can and make some judgment calls. So people will have to decide for themselves whether or not they want to use these supplements. I would think about it more seriously if I were in a situation where I had a disease that where I knew my conversion enzymes weren't very good.
Mm-hmm.
In those cases, I think that people are probably, it's a probably not a bad idea to take them once in a while. I don't think it's something people need to do every day, though. I think two or three times a week is probably plenty, even for those individuals.
I want to thank you, Brenda, for saying, I don't know.
Oh, there's so much we don't know.
There's so much we don't know. And how many people do we go to for information who will not say, I don't know, when they don't know?
Yeah.
They'll make
up
all kinds of stuff. And I just have so much more trust in what you say when you say, I don't know. So thank you.
Oh, well, thank you. Well, you know what? There's just, this is such a baby science.
Mm-hmm.
What we do know today may be absolutely incorrect a year from now.
So stay tuned.
Doing the best we can and trying to keep on top of the literature and trying to provide people. You know, my goal is really very simple. I want people who want to be plant-based to eat a more compassionate way to enjoy the best possible health they can. Because when they enjoy great health, they're sending a message to the rest of the world, you don't need meat to be healthy. In fact, if you eliminate it, you'll probably be healthier. And so that's really my goal, is I just want people to be able to do this as well as possible.
Well, that's a great way to tie this half hour up. Beautiful. Thank you.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Karen.
Yes, it's always a pleasure, and I'm always learning, and I'm sure next year I'll learn even more because you'll know more by then. But I wanted to refer people to your website, Brenda
Davis, RD.
RD.com.
.com. And then we actually have another website that Vasanto and I put up called becomingvegan.ca.
Right. Becomingvegan.ca for Canada, because you're in Canada.
Right. That's correct.
Yes. And
because .com was gone.
Oh, well, .com is overrated anyway. Great. And just to have that excellent resource at your fingertips, because not all of this stuff is online and trustworthy. You can pick up Becoming Vegan Express Edition, or if you really want to know it all, Becoming Vegan Comprehensive Edition. There you go. Thank you, Brenda.
Thanks so much. Thank you, Karen. Have a great day.
Okay, you too.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. All right, let's take a little break. And when we come back, we're going to be talking about a new product and a company that's making a tempeh. They make it out of soy, but they're making some new ones, and they're including hemp and other beans. I'm really looking forward to hearing about that with Smiling Hara Tempeh. We'll be right back. Hey, everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass, and we're back with the second part of It's All About Food today on November 4th, 2014, Election Day here in the United States. Get out and vote if you haven't already. And we are going to be talking about tempeh in the next half hour and some other delicious topics. And we're going to be talking about Smiling Hara Tempeh. Sarah Yancey and Chad Oliphant started Smiling Hara, which translates to Happy Belly, in 2009 with the intention of providing an organic and locally sourced tempeh to customers in the Southeast United States. And we have co-founder Chad Oliphant with us to talk about the company and their upcoming projects. He studied at the Cushy Macrobiotic Institute in 2000, where he learned to make tempeh, among many other fermented foods. Chad, thank you for joining me today.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So I was really excited when I heard about Smiling Hara Tempeh and all the things that you're working on accomplishing right now. Very exciting stuff. Let's get into the meat of all of that.
All right.
So first, let's talk about tempeh and your company making tempeh.
Yeah, we're Smiling Hara. We're out of Asheville, North Carolina. We've been in business for about 5 years now. And we do small batch artisan tempehs. So what we've attempted to do is kind of take it back both at the same time provide a product that is a little more true to what a homemade tempeh or a traditional tempeh would be, and that at the same time we've put out a couple of products that kind of put a twist on tempeh, particularly gravitating towards soy-free versions of the product. As you know, tempeh is a traditional Southeast Asian food from the Indonesia-Malaysia area, and is traditionally made from soybeans. But here in the U.S., we've had a trend of people who are kind of looking to mitigate the amount of tempeh they have in their diets, and so we've been looking to provide an option for that.
Well, that's genius. And I have to say, I'm sorry, I haven't tried your black bean tempeh and your black-eyed pea tempeh, and I can't wait to do that. I love tempeh, soy tempeh, and there's so many things I love about it. It's a fermented food. It's full of flavor. Some people, I don't know what it is, genetic or whatever, have this fermented food aversion. So putting them aside, those who don't mind fermented foods, tempeh is really delicious, and it doesn't have it's a low sodium food, and it's good if you just crumble it on raw salads or if you cook with it. It's got a nice chewy texture. It's just phenomenal, and you can slice it, you can cube it, you can do so many different things, and for those who are transitioning and reducing or eliminating meat in their diets, this is a great food to just replace meat. You can grate it like chopped meat. It's just very versatile.
Yeah, indeed.
And so, you know, there's a lot of people who are either allergic to soy or afraid of soy or have heard some misinformation about soy. But also we should eat a balanced diet, and it's great to eat other beans. So you've made a similar product with some other beans. So does it taste similar or is it different? What are those other ones like?
Yeah, they're different. They have their own distinct. The black bean is very much has a black bean flavor. So, you know, we love to use that in tacos and enchiladas and, you know, your more southwestern type dishes. The black-eyed pea, you know, with these non-soybeans, they have a bit lower protein content and higher starch. So with the higher starch, you get more fermentation that takes place in the process.
Ooh.
And so you get a bit of a brighter, fruitier flavor out of these.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, protein can be overrated sometimes, and we don't need as much as some people think we do. So I think it's...
That's right.
Yeah.
And the protein that is in tempeh is... That's one of the beautiful things about tempeh is that through that fermentation process, your proteins are being broken down into the simple amino acids, and it's really easy for your body to assimilate these proteins. So even though it may not have as much protein content as some meats and whatnot, your body is going to uptake and digest and utilize more of protein.
Now, I'm imagining because they're fermented, people aren't going to experience as much flatulence, gas, when they eat these tempeh versions of black beans and black-eyed peas.
Exactly.
Yeah, beautiful. All right. So that's good stuff. And you're in Whole Foods and stores like that?
Yeah, we're in Whole Foods throughout the Southeast region. We're in a number of Earth Fair stores, and we're just starting to branch out of the Western Carolina area here and starting to get our products out further out into other regions. And right now what we're working on, you know, one of the beautiful things also with using these non-soybeans is that, you know, with the GMO issue, and a lot of people are concerned about GMOs in their diets, and with, you know, we use only U.S. organically grown GMO-free beans, but there's no guarantee, you know, with the way cross-contaminations work,
yep.
You know, there's some question about that. But when you're looking at black-eyed peas and what they call the pulse crops, there are no GMOs. So you
not
have no
yet,
concerns
anyway.
About that. What's that?
Not yet, anyway.
Not yet. So we can still take advantage of that. And so what we're in the process of doing is we're really excited. We have a Kickstarter campaign going on right now, and we're looking to launch a new line of tempeh that we're calling Hempeh. So we have teamed up with an organization, great organization out of Rockcastle County, Kentucky, by the name of Growing Warriors. And Growing Warriors is a nonprofit organization that's veteran-operated, and what they're doing is training military veterans to become farmers. And Growing Warriors is one of the pioneer organizations that Pioneer Farms that is the first to grow hemp in Kentucky this year.
Wow.
So we're going to be able to source our hemp and our beans for this product line from Growing Warriors, from veteran farmers, and be able to contribute back additionally, you know, through the proceeds of the sales of the product.
I mean, I love this on so many levels. Can we just talk about hemp for a minute, how we haven't been, it hasn't been legal to grow hemp in this country for a long time.
1957 was the last time, the last legal hemp field prior to this year was in Wisconsin in 1957.
And do you know why we stopped growing hemp, why it wasn't legal anymore?
Well, it was initially outlawed in 1937 under the Marijuana Tax Act, so it was grouped in with marijuana. There's a lot of information and speculation as to the reasons why hemp was included with marijuana. There was a piece of equipment, Popular Mechanics did an article within a year prior to the Marijuana Tax Act being passed. They developed a piece of equipment to be able to mass harvest hemp. And so for the first time, hemp was really in position to overtake some lumber interests, some petrochemical interests.
Mm.
And, you know, the speculation goes on from there. So it was made illegal in 1937, but then brought back in 1942 under the Hemp for Victory campaign. Essentially what happened is that once Japan occupied the Philippines in World War II, it took away our hemp supply. So the government put farmers back to work growing hemp, and that lasted a few years, and then they kind of grouped it back in with drugs and did away with it. So we import over $500 million worth of hemp into this country every year, and I think it's one of the things that gives me the most hope these days. You know, that since 2008, that word hope had been kind of tied to, you know, individuals or saviors that could really come and solve some of our problems. But lo and behold, it's actually a plant that gives me hope, a plant that can come in and fix some of these economic problems, fix some of our health problems. You know,
it's
beautiful.
A
great solution.
It's very aggravating. Just one more story that we hear about how our government has made the wrong choices for us, probably based on some corrupt information to promote other businesses that aren't as good for our health and for our planet, like you were mentioning, petrochemical and others. And it's so frustrating because hemp is like this super plant. Not only does it give us these omega-3 rich hemp seeds, which make wonderful hemp milk, but the plant can provide fibers for cloths and so many different things that we can use. And
exactly, it can
reduce the
amount of trees we use for paper. It can be used as a building material with the hempcrete technologies that's been developed. It's food, it's medicine, it's fuel, and now they're even looking into energy storage as a way to replace graphene as a supercapacitor. I mean, this plant, and you have to consider, but for the bulk of the Industrial Revolution, our scientists haven't been able to play with this plant freely and fully explore the uses of it because it's been illegal.
Yes.
So it's a really exciting time to be alive. I mean, this is just great. I think there's four or five states today that are voting on, full-on legalization of recreational cannabis, which is really ultimately where it needs to go. It needs, you know, this war on drugs and putting people in jail and destroying families over this plant needs to stop.
Absolutely. We're not putting the right people in jail. I mean, so many people get away with these huge white-collar corporate crimes, and, you know, somebody that's just getting high on a little weed is put away for a long time, and it's just not balanced.
Yeah.
So can we grow hemp anywhere in the country now?
No, there's only, I'm not sure. It's kind of hard to keep track between, you know, medical marijuana and hemp. I think we're maybe 15 to 20 states for hemp growing now. And
right.
There's only a couple of states that implemented it this year, Colorado and Kentucky, and there might have been a couple other small pilot projects. But I know our neighboring state of Tennessee here is getting ready, and I live 10 miles from the Tennessee border, but they're getting ready to put it pretty wide open for hemp cultivation for 2015. So that's really exciting. And I think within the next 2 years, we'll probably see over half the states have opened it up.
Well, this is a beautiful thing that you're doing, the fact that you've teamed up with Growing Warriors, giving an opportunity to military veterans, and we need a lot more of this. And then plus, we get this nutritious food. Now, what is hempe really like?
Okay, so what we're doing with hempe, we're still developing the product and dialing it in, but hempe, essentially, we're going to take the soy-free tempeh and we're going to fortify it with hemp seed. So basically by doing that, we boost the protein content, we get those omegas in there, and it's just a really great way to incorporate hemp into your diet. And it's going through the processing and the fermentation so that, you know, all of those nutrients are going to be much more bioavailable to you when you eat it.
Right. It's very exciting. So you have a Kickstarter, and where can people find this Kickstarter to help you out? Because I think this is such a great project.
Yeah, thank you. If you go to Kickstarter.com, you can just search us, Hempe, H-E-M-P-E-H, or you can go to our website, which is www.smilingharatempe.com. That's S-M-I-L-I-N-G-H-A-R-A-T-E-M-P-E-H.
Excellent. All right. So what are your favorite things to do with tempeh? Let's talk about delicious things.
Well, I'm a big taco guy, so I really like to do the tacos. So we do tacos a lot. I do a lot of just simple preparations, you know, just a simple meal of grain like quinoa or rice with stir-fried tempeh and vegetables, a little bit of kale thrown in there. You know, that's a good, just basic dish to get, you know, a really good, nutritious meal. We just held a fundraising event here 2 weeks ago in Asheville. We had a barbecue tempeh challenge. It's kind of an annual thing we do. The first year we had a contest where we invite out like a dozen local restaurants. We have a nice tempeh scene here in Asheville, probably the best tempeh chefs in the United States that have been at times forced to use our product due to the amount of people in this area that just love eating that way, you know, that love tempeh and love eating locally made food. So the first year we did a tempeh Reuben challenge.
Yeah.
So that's a pretty common menu item, you know, is a tempeh Reuben.
Yeah.
And then we did tacos last year, and then this year was barbecue. So barbecue is another great way to do with tempeh. It does great if you smoke it or just, you know, fry it and throw it with some barbecue sauce kind of thing, make a sandwich out of it. It's just so many different versions of barbecue, you know, different textures and preparations that, you know, that the local chefs here just get really creative with it.
Yeah, we have a barbecue tempeh recipe on our ResponsibleEatingAndLiving.com website, and we make it a lot. It's really yummy.
Excellent.
Yes, excellent. Indeed. Okay, well, we just have a few more minutes, and I wanted to understand what brought you to study at the Kushi Macrobiotic Institute.
Well, it was just something I was introduced to. There was a friend of a friend who was diagnosed with cancer, and so she... my friend went along with her for a consultation with Michio Kushi, and my friend returned just really inspired and an immediate convert to macrobiotics. And so through her, I got to start, you know, sampling the food and getting to know what it was all about. And really, it was the philosophy. George Osawa, who was the kind of the founding father of macrobiotics and really is responsible for bringing the health food movement to the West back in the late 50s. You know, so reading his works, the Macrobiotic Way is a great book, but just this philosophy of personal responsibility and being really responsible for your own health, your own diet, you know, and really thinking on a deeper level about how we treat our bodies.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went up to the Kushi Institute, kind of blind. I'd done some reading, done some eating, and just went up there and spent a year on a work study program and just watching, just experiencing the transformation within myself physically and emotionally, and mentally, just how it affected me. But then watching people come through these programs and hearing all of the stories of people who had cured themselves of cancer and had AIDS go into remission, seeing diabetics recover was just really profound and undeniable.
You know, pretty powerful.
It's all right there. Yeah. And then, you know, really you take that and it extends beyond just, you know, my health and my diet, and it goes to the way the food is grown and the health of the planet and seeing how all these things are connected, that the bacterial and microbial life in the soil is connected to my own microbial inner environment, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of connections, I just want to, before we go, because we just have a few more minutes left, I wanted to get back to those growing warriors, the military veterans. And I'm personally someone who is somewhat of a conscientious objector. I don't believe in killing anybody for anything. But, you know, we do have some very brave individuals that go out and they come home and they're not treated very well. And so many of them suffer from all kinds of problems, post-traumatic stress, and we do not give them the therapy that they need. And I love this concept where these military veterans get the opportunity to work in nature, grow hemp, and have it go into a food that is nutritious and healing, and they're healing themselves at the same time. It's all connected, and how beautiful is that?
Absolutely, absolutely. You're talking to the guys that I interact with, Mike Lewis, Fred Lewis, you really get it when you hear them speak on it. Everyone should check out growingwarriors.org. You can watch a video on their website. Our Kickstarter video has a little profile on them. And it is. It's just, they're dealing with food insecurity and the amount of vets who are on the SNAP program, you know, or come back here. It's hard to find work, especially one that's attached to a sense of mission and purpose like they're used to, you know, that these men and women are used to being really attached to a mission and a purpose in life. And so it provides that. It's an easy area for them to see the importance of what they're doing. And then just the poetry of growing warriors being attached to the hemp and one of the first to grow the hemp in this country again, because last time we were growing it, it was a hemp for victory movement that was, it was growing for the military, but there is that association. And, it's interesting. I just read an article in Italy. The Italian government has put their army to work, active military, growing medical marijuana for the country of Italy. So I would love to see this just take hold through our veteran organization first, you know, with getting connected to, you know, raising good, healthy, naturally grown food, and to see that bleed its way back into the military somehow. How different would this world be if instead of sending drones to bomb in Syria, we were sending people over to train folks to grow their own food, to train farmers, to train, you know.
Yeah, let's
go that route instead of killing people.
Yeah, let's just close our eyes for a minute and hold that thought and then put it out there. That's a wonderful vision. Yeah. Thank you, Chad. And I didn't get to talk to Sarah today, but she's your co-founder.
Yeah, she's lovely. She says hello.
Say hello back. Yeah, great. Well, thank you so much for joining me on It's All About Food, and I hope your Kickstarter is very successful. I look forward to seeing hemp aid all over the country soon.
No, great. Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, take care.
All right, you too. Bye-bye.
Bye. Well, here we are. It's the end of another program, isn't it? So I'm Karen Hartglass. You've been listening to It's All About Food, and I hope you do join me at responsibleeatingandliving.com and send me an email at info@realmeals.org. Tell me what you think of this show and what you'd like to hear more of, okay? In the meanwhile, have a delicious week.